This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, what do Black liberation and climate change have in common? The CIA uses dirty tricks to keep its torture practices secret. And the Black is Back Coalition holds its annual conference in Philadelphia this weekend.
But first, the massive water cutoffs are set to resume in Detroit August 25th after a brief pause. Plans are now also afoot to privatize parking in the city as part of the bankruptcy process imposed on Detroit. Abiyomi Ezekwe of the Moratorium Now Coalition says it's all part of a scheme to milk Detroit dry.
It's part of the same process. It's been taking place over successive administrations. I think the crisis of the overall American capitalist system has worsened, and therefore there's more pressure being put on the municipalities to extract more wealth for the benefit of Wall Street. And we see that clearly in Detroit with the imposition of emergency management some 17 months ago, and then the illegally enforced bankruptcy just over a year ago. The underlying agenda is the selling off of public assets, the destruction of the strength to the extent that it still exists of the labor movement, the expropriation of public pension funds, and the breaking up and also the selling off of public assets, i.e. Belle Isle, which is now under control of the state of Michigan. There's the Detroit Public Lighting, which it was exposed recently. The Public Lighting Authority that's been created, supposedly to relight the city, is an abysmal failure. The character of the relighting process is far less than being sufficient to what people need in the neighborhoods in regard to safety. And also, the issue of the water, which has struck a chord with people not only in Detroit, but also around the country and indeed internationally, because despite the fact that the emergency manager and even echoed by Mayor Duggan, since he was ostensibly given authority over the Detroit Water and Sewage Department, that they plan to continue targeting neighborhoods for shutoffs under the guise that people are utilizing water, quote, illegally, unquote, or that they're not paying the water bills. But they won't acknowledge the complete disarray that the DWSD is in terms of overcharging people for water, terminating people's services who don't owe the designated amount that they claim will trigger a shutoff, and also the effort to privatize the Detroit Water and Sewage Department. We have one of the best water systems in the United States. We're surrounded by 20% of the world's fresh water. There's no reason for the system to be privatized other than profit. So this is the underlying agenda, and they want to do it with the parking system. They've deliberately not reinvested in parking meters, and they've jacked up the parking ticket rates. So they want to, of course, outsource, and there's no guarantee that this is going to improve the efficiency of it or bring more money into the city.
Now, we have to emphasize that you speak of the mayor, and of course, the city council voted against privatization of the parking meters, but the city council and the mayor have no power, and the voters of Detroit have no power to elect officials that can actually effectuate change or stop changes from being made.
This is what's so interesting about this current period, that the ruling class, the 1%, cannot even afford bourgeois democracy in a traditional sense, i.e. they cannot afford to allow people to elect politicians. And of course, no, even though they're weak, even though many of them are corrupt, they still create a situation that slows down their mad drive towards privatization. And I think this is indicative of what's going on in Detroit. The mayor and the city council, in essence, work at the pleasure of the emergency manager who was appointed by the multi-million-dollar venture capitalist governor, Rick Snyder, who's up for re-election later on this year. So there's no real democracy, even from a bourgeois standpoint, in the city of Detroit. Now, the mayor, the first white mayor elected, ostensibly elected in the city, in four decades. There was a tremendous amount of controversy about him running. He didn't even qualify in terms of the residency rules to get on the ballot. He ran as a write-in candidate, and there was tremendous amounts of criticism and skepticism about the veracity of the elections that took place last fall and summer in the city of Detroit. But all that aside, his history is one of privatization. He was CEO of the Detroit Medical Center, which was a nonprofit entity. It was sold off to a private insurance and healthcare group out of Nashville. They in turn were purchased by another group. So we have no reason to doubt that he has the same agenda for other public assets, i.e. the Detroit Water and Sewage Department. They've already issued RFPs, requests for proposals during the spring for the private administration of the Detroit Water and Sewage Department. So this whole process has virtually nothing to do with the supposed $90 million in arrears that is owed by residential customers in regard to water bills. It has more to do with the fact that their real agenda is to privatize the Detroit Water and Sewage Department, and that is only being done to further disempower the people, to further weaken the workforce, and also to reap profits for their class allies.
Now, Kevin Orr, the state-imposed emergency dictator, his time in office is coming to an end, at least it's supposed to, sometime this fall. Is there an opening for the city to escape this kind of dictatorship?
Only if the people organize and mobilize with a program of reclaiming some semblance of local control. Orr's tenure can be extended by the governor over and above the wishes of the city council. There can be a situation where Mayor Duggan and the city council implements policies that are indistinguishable from what the emergency manager is doing. Even under the former Bing administration, which went out in 2013, they were attempting to impose the same austerity measures, the same cuts to pensions, weakening of the trade union movements, cutting back on benefits allocated to workers, pay cuts, all of that. But they weren't in a position, the Bing administrations, to implement it as quickly as the ruling class wanted to implement it. So they had to appoint an emergency manager who, in turn, after facing resistance, illegally put the city in bankruptcy. And, of course, there was a federal judge who said that the city was eligible for bankruptcy, even though the emergency manager and Jones Day Corporation, which is effectively managing the affairs of the city, did not negotiate with the so-called creditors, being the bondholders, the banks, even the trade unions and the retirees, the homeowners, and so forth. So all of this is completely illegal, even under U.S. constitutional law, even under the bourgeois norms of governance. This does not meet, you know, muster. But at the same time, as I mentioned before, they are in a desperate situation. We're talking about perhaps trillions of dollars involved in public pension funds, trillions more involved in public assets such as waterways, parks, lighting systems, public transportation systems that the 1% wants to get total control of in order to enhance their own profit margin. It has nothing to do with efficiency. It has nothing to do with improving the conditions of people who live in the city. In fact, in the city of Detroit, public transportation has worsened. The streets maintenance has worsened. The public lighting has worsened. And let alone any actual control or manipulation by the masses of the political direction of the city is almost non-existent, only to the extent that we can protest and demonstrate and cause an embarrassment to the ruling class will we have any influence. But no, in terms of what they claim their objectives are, they've done a very poor job in realizing them.
Now, these politicians, these Detroit politicians, city council people, and previous mayors, all of these folks were Democrats, and yet you say they paved the way for the Republican-nominated emergency financial dictator and his machinations. And President Obama has done nothing to alleviate the situation in Detroit.
Yes, he has done something, not to alleviate the situation, but to worsen it. In fact, the Obama administration submitted a brief in the bankruptcy court, in essence saying that it was constitutional what these entities were doing to disempower people in the city of Detroit. He called a meeting at the White House earlier this year with the likes of Dan Gilbert, who's a multi-billionaire banker and landowner here in the city of Detroit. He owns over 60 buildings downtown that were essentially given to him by the city. And he held a meeting with Dan Gilbert and other leading capitalists in the city of Detroit, and in essence signed off on this massive Detroit blight removal task force, which is headed by none other than Dan Gilbert. Here, Dan Gilbert, the head of Quicken Loans, which is a real estate firm, a finance firm, he himself owns over 60 buildings in downtown Detroit, was made head of a blight removal task force. Now, that is clearly a conflict of interest. What is the objective of this blight removal task force? They've hired a mapping firm that has gone through the entire city to designate so-called abandoned and blighted properties for seizure and for demolition. And in fact, people are being harassed as a result of this, not even a governmental entity. They're threatening people to sue them for the title of their homes. So all of this is being done to, in fact, push more African-Americans, more Latinos, more working class and poor white people out of the city of Detroit. That is their agenda, and they're going up on the rents. They're going up on prices. This is a similar situation that they created in Washington, D.C., beginning 2-3 decades ago. They're trying to enact the same policy here in the city of Detroit.
And that policy being one of planned and methodical gentrification.
Yes, it is. And people are not able to afford to live in the city of Detroit. If you go from downtown to midtown, you cannot find an apartment under $1,100 to $1,500 a month. You cannot find mortgaged properties that are in the range of working and poor people can afford. So this is the real agenda, and this is being championed by the corporate media. The raising of rents, the raising of prices, the forcing out of the poor is, according to them, an indication that the city is coming back.
So this core city, in terms of what the developers yes. consider to be the viable city, the city yes. where the rents are being raised and the new enterprises are planned, this is a success story as far as they're concerned, and the rest of Detroit is a kind of hinterland.
Yes. And, you know, like our parents used to say, they would call it urban renewal, but in fact, it was Negro removal. And that's what we have here in the city of Detroit. We have massive Negro removal that is going on here. Now we can add the Latino population, many of whom are recent immigrants to the city of Detroit who had revitalized working class communities, particularly in Southwest Detroit, with small businesses and homes and social organizations and even the churches are now themselves being forced out because of the role of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the role of the banks in terms of foreclosures, the denial of loans and credit, the small business people. And, of course, they want to bring in a new layer of immigrants who are, in fact, more capitalist-oriented, who have certain skills that they feel they can exploit. So this is the situation that's going on here. And the attacks on pensions, the attacks on unions and public assets is going on not just here but across the country in Memphis, in Los Angeles, and many other cities across the United States. We see a similar process. It may not be as loud, it may not be as blatant, but it's essentially the same process.
That was Abiyomi Ezekwe of Detroit's Moratorium Now Coalition. He's also editor of the Pan-African Newswire.
This weekend, Philadelphia will be the site of a national conference of the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations, which was formed in 2009. We asked Black is Back chairman Omali Yeshitela what the coalition has learned over the past 5 years.
Well, I think one of the things that we've learned is that it is always correct to take the correct position regarding political questions, despite their apparent popularity or lack thereof at any given moment. As the Black is Back Coalition, we were the first out of the gate in terms of the condemnation of Barack Hussein Obama's wars. We were the first to have that demonstration at the White House, the first national demonstration, period, and the first and perhaps the only African mobilization against Barack Obama's policies there. And initially, there was so much drama involved in it that some of the people who we were trying to recruit to participate in the coalition literally cussed us out and absolutely wouldn't have anything to do with it. But over the years, what we've seen, of course, is that more and more people are being awakened to the catastrophe that the Obama regime has meant, not only to the struggle and rights of African people here within the United States, but to the rights of people around the world. We've seen him become the Drone Meister, and we've seen this horrible role that he's played in the massacre in Gaza. So I think that that's one of the key things we've learned. I think beyond that, one of the most important things about the Black is Black Coalition is our assault on sectarianism, where there was an assumption by many that different political groups and ideological and political persuasions could not unite in the common interest of people in common struggle against imperialism. I think the 5 years of Black is Black Coalition has proved that to be fallacious, and also I think it's set a great example for people that we can work together and we can oppose imperialism without attempting to impose on anybody particular agendas that go beyond the broad principles of unity that we've established for ourselves and the basic resolutions that's come out of the conferences that we've held every year since our founding.
And to the extent that there's been resistance to a kind of black left coalition, it's been because many who call themselves persons of the left still can't turn loose of Obama.
And that's an extraordinary thing, because many of the people who we're talking about had established some reputations as being black communists and black nationalists and adamant, they said, opponents of imperialism and U.S. imperialism in particular. But I think the Obama experience has shown us that in reality that they have been simply white patriots in black face. Their patriotism toward the United States government is something that has been outstanding, and the Barack Obama experience is something that's helped to really clarify that. And while for some it won't be meaningful, but I think that many of us in the Black is Black Coalition intend to continue holding them as examples of just how shallow and hollow the declarations of people who've been able to pose as leaders without having to face any real contest, how shallow and empty they are. I think that's one of the most important things about what the Black is Black Coalition has been able to do, because it's easy enough to be for something or against something when there is really no test. And the test, I think, for all of us was the Barack Obama experience. I think that this was some hurdle that many were unable to deal with. And the Black is Black Coalition, I think, was just a magnificent template. And I say this recognizing that, as you remember, there were people who were for Obama with the NAACP and who really tried to unite with the coalition despite being pro-Obama, but recognized that his policies were bad and that what he was representing at the moment was bad. And so they were even, despite that, able to unite with the coalition as objective. And at least one of those persons became quite clear who Obama was before his term was up and before, of course, she died. And I'm talking here specifically about Queen Mother Dorothy Lewis, who was pro-Obama. And there was a minister out of North Carolina who initially tried to work with us. He was the second vice president of the North Carolina State NAACP, and he was just literally hounded, him and the NAACP, to such an extent they had to retreat. But I think this Obama issue was a litmus test for many forces who characterize themselves as being left, and I don't know if they're ever going to be able to recover from this.
Back in 2009, when Black is Back held its march in November to the White House, President Obama had just made his famous speech in Cairo, his so-called outreach to the Arab and Muslim world. Now the United States is in the position of having back to the hilt Israel's invasion and killing of 2,000 Palestinians in Gaza.
I hope that if nothing else occurs, with this mobilization, this conference that we're doing, that the myth of the specialness of the Jewish state, this horrendous entity that has been used not only against the Arab-Palestinian people, but in many ways used against the peoples all around the world. I hope that if nothing else happens, that this thing is deflated and that it should never be able to recover and hide behind religion and the story of the Holocaust. And Obama has played an extraordinary role to declaring Israel's right to self-defense as if an occupying colonial power killing people who are resisting is defending itself. So I think that this is going to be really important, and I really get a sense that more and more people here in this country and around the world have come to some conclusions that will make it impossible for white power to rule in the same old way.
The black misleadership class in this country, almost to a man and a woman, and including all of the Congressional Black Caucus, has either heartily endorsed or remained silent about this Israeli apartheid nation's aggressions in Gaza.
Well, it's a matter of this instance of assuming they know what side their bread is buttered on, but this is going to be proved to be wrong. I truly believe that Israel has ripped any notion of some specialness that may have allowed it to cover its egregious actions against the people in the past. I think that's gone. And I think that most of the Negro politicians, of course, are afraid to death of the Zionist strength in terms of being able to make and destroy careers and fund and defund careers. I think that what they will see in the near future is that Israel is not in the same place it was politically, geopolitically, in the past. All over in Europe, I see that at least one person who has left the British Parliament, and this was a right-wing woman, who, because she said that England's position on the Gaza question was morally indefensible, it is something that is being seriously discussed in France, and France has functioned as a Zionist entity itself for the longest period of time, but people in France and people in England, it's all on the radio, all the talk shows are discussing this barbarism that Israel has demonstrated in Gaza, and it's increasingly impossible or difficult, even for traditional pro-Israeli Zionist politicians in Europe to support it. And I think that there's going to be fallout in this country as well. I know there's fallout within the general African community here around it, even as we see the sellout misleadership politicians jumping on the Israeli bandwagon. Increasingly, I think that that's going to be impossible to do. And I think their careers are going to suffer mightily as a consequence of being in bed with the barbarous Israeli Jewish state.
5 years ago, when Black Is Back was formed and issued an inclusive denunciation of President Obama's foreign policies, the corporate media were describing a new era between the United States and Russia, an era of collaboration on nuclear affairs and economic affairs. And what has been wrought since then?
I think that they are truly looking at a new relationship between Russia and the United States. The difficulty for the United States has been, first, reconciling itself to the fact that it is an entity that is in decline. Some of its most significant pundits and even Obama's advisors, such as Zbigniew Brzezinski, have contrived new formula for trying to deal with Russia and China and entities like that, with the assumption being explicitly stated that America is never going to be able to rule and govern in the same way and lead the world in the same way, and that it's got to find a way to incorporate Russia and China into its embrace in a fashion that still will allow it to lead, but to recognize that it can't lead in the same old way or to lead from behind some instances. And what has happened, of course, is that Russia and China have not been quite willing to join the club on the terms that have been established by the United States and by what is often characterized as the West, meaning white. So that Russia and China have both refused to join in as junior partners. Russia is finally saying to the United States that it's not going to allow itself to be more and more encircled with NATO, and the United States using other vehicles to encircle it politically, economically, militarily, and it has initiated a pushback. And this is very difficult for the United States to deal with, especially since it's being confronted throughout the Asian Pacific Basin by China. It's being confronted in Africa by China. China's growing influence economically and politically, both in Asia and in Africa, has been confronted by what people throughout South America are doing to try to wrest control of their existence, their lives. And so the Ukrainian question is not just an isolated issue that the United States has to deal with. It has to deal with it in the context of an entire changing world, the foundation sort of being shifting under its feet, and how to deal with that is a critical question. And what makes it especially significant at this moment is I truly believe that the U.S. is in a state of a certain kind of desperation that will allow it to go to great and dangerous efforts to try and maintain the status quo. And I think that is a dangerous thing that we're looking at, but it's never going to be the same again, and Russia is saying it. In fact, one of the Russian commentators made an interesting statement a month or two ago that Russia is the only country that could reduce America into a nuclear ash. And this, of course, has made the United States have to deal with Russia differently from, for example, how it's dealt with Libya, how it's dealt with Syria, how it's dealt with Central African Republic of Mali, the United States and white power in general. The Russians are claiming that the United States is behind the coup, Ukraine, that it is engaged in attempting to dominate that area, and that there's an illegitimate government that's in Ukraine now as a consequence of United States activities. And while initially many of the pundits from the United States and even from the BBC were exclaiming how Russia sounds insane, that they've never heard anybody talk like this before, that Putin is saying things directly in opposition, contrary to what everybody else is saying, the fact is they've never had to listen to anybody else before. And so everybody has been saying more or less what Putin has been said about U.S. and Western interference in their lives, but nobody else has been able to reduce America to a nuclear ash and therefore be able to get the attention of the Americans and much of the European white power. So it's an interesting and delicate kind of situation that the United States is dealing with right now, and dangerous for the peoples around the world, because it is not only Ukraine, but they're doing insane things in Asia, challenging China's airspace and things like that. So they will not be able to recover politically, and therefore I think we're going to see these desperate attempts to do things in many instances as they used to be done in the past. The day has changed, and they can't do things today as they were able to do yesterday.
And back to Philadelphia, August 16th and 17th, the Black is Back annual conference. What do you hope will be accomplished there?
I think this is going to be a splendid conference, and for me, one of the most important things that will occur, of course, is that we will have an opportunity to discuss some of the issues that we're talking about now. I think our community needs to have a position about if this war between the United States and Russia should happen, you know, how should we see it? What should our stance be around that? I think that also we'll have an opportunity to examine what our reality is as Africans in this country, and I'm most hopeful that this conference can be used also as a build-up and jump-off for November 1st and 2nd, which is when the annual march on the White House is going to occur. And I'm hoping that out of this, we'll be able to win participation from every sector of the so-called left, white left, black left, whomever, peace movements, et cetera, to move on the White House behind the red, black, and green on November 1st and 2nd. I really believe that the consequences of this permanent warfare as it is now manifesting itself in Gaza, as the contest that's becoming increasingly dangerous with Ukraine, what we know is happening in places like Somalia, et cetera, I think that we're at a place now where we can call for and really get a massive mobilization on November 1st and 2nd. So I'm hoping that this conference, in addition to everything that we accomplish here, consolidating the coalition, winning more people to participate in the coalition, I'm hoping that this will also be a jump off, a major jump off for November 1st and 2nd, Washington, D.C.
Omali Yeshitela of the Black is Back Coalition.
When Jackson, Mississippi Mayor Chukwe Lumumba suddenly died in office earlier this year, it was a setback for plans to organize the mostly black city's economy and politics on a more cooperative and just basis. One of the organizations that grew out of Lumumba's effort is called Cooperation Jackson, which recently joined the Climate Justice Alliance. Organizer Kali Akundo explains.
The Climate Justice Alliance There's an alliance of grassroots forces from throughout the country that came together starting in 2010 to combat the impacts of climate change in our communities that folks are already feeling. So in California, you got drought, you got the longstanding scourge of environmental racism in a lot of our communities. And folks have just started putting that all together in this fight against the Copenhagen deals and some of the UN stuff, and then what the United States government was or was not doing in terms of reducing carbon emissions and paying its fair share to ease the burden around the transition around carbon emissions. And so all these fights were going on the local level, and folks start looking to figure out how do you link up with folks in the continent, the African continent, the Caribbean, Latin America, the indigenous nations throughout the world. How do we link up together and fight against imperialism in a coordinated fashion? The Climate Justice Alliance is really born out of discussions around that. And the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement has been a part of the Climate Justice Alliance even before Cooperation Jackson, for some of the earlier iterations of it. But Cooperation Jackson decided to join as its own entity, decided to join the alliance, primarily because we're looking to not only control the means of production in Jackson and eventually throughout Mississippi and beyond, but we're trying to make sure that how we produce goods and services is different than the standard capitalist methods of doing so, which are over-relying on petrochemicals and unhealthy products, GMOs, etc. So that's an integral part of our strategy. So it made some sense in terms of us looking to explore new ways of producing goods and services that are not only distributed in an equitable manner, whether it's distributed ownership and distributed reward amongst the people, but how do we do it in a way that's going to ensure that our kids and grandkids and their great-grandkids are here to enjoy the fruits of the earth as we presently understand them, with clean water, clean air, and enough food and abundance to go around. That's part of our thinking around that.
There's long been a strain in the environmental movement that insists that in order to reverse ecological damage, production of societies has to be cut back and a kind of austerity. But you guys say that you can tackle the climate crisis while still providing employment for Americans who are not employed.
That's right. I mean, not only can we do it, we have to do it. It's an imperative. We're not in the climate game or the environmental game to just kind of keep the status quo in place. We are diametrically opposed to that, and just see that in many respects as just a kind of a racist ploy to keep things not only where they at, but perhaps even worse, because who gets to determine, once that austerity is kind of imposed to permeate vision even more, who's going to remain and who's going to have to go? And if we follow the typical logic of white supremacy, we know that African and indigenous peoples and Asian peoples are likely to be those who are not only put on the chopping block, but ultimately disposed of. So our thing is, the capitalist system as it presently exists produces a tremendous amount of waste, and it produces, in fair measure, all the goods and services that humanity can live and live well off of. It just does so with a very restricted profit motive. And so a lot of things are actually destroyed or underproduced or produced in great quantities with very little practical need. So we have to revert that and use the methods that have been innovated, those which kind of sustain life and make some adjustments on how the energy sources are provided to them. We have to adjust that to make sure that everyone can have their fair share to the social goods that are produced, because that's what all these things are. They're social goods, and we have to look at them in that manner.
So you're directly linking the climate crisis with the capitalist economic crisis.
Absolutely. I mean, as we understand the assault on the environment, and that's really what it is, that is something that grows out of capitalist logic, and it grows out of the imperative imperialism to constantly expand and constantly have to grow, at 3% to 7% growth rate just for the system to kind of stay stable. We live on a finite planet with finite resources. They can be used in a number of creative ways. The Earth, over billions of years of evolution, has done a tremendous job of making sure that nothing is wasted, everything is used. But if the capitalist system, which produces waste, which tries to externalize it, tries to hide it, doesn't recycle, doesn't see it as being profitable because everything has to be new and shiny, as part of the logic, we have to change that whole system and kind of get back into productive relationships and only take care of people first and foremost, but take care of our environment. And capitalism is very intentionally just sees the environment as another resource that needs to be exploited or there to be exploited without end. And so that productive system has brought us to the point of where we're at today with this system. The capitalist and imperialist system is bringing humanity and a lot of the other species on the planet that we share this planet with to the verge of extinction. And we got to look at this very, very, very serious, and we got to start creating system change now to avert this calamity that's kind of staring us in the face.
And how does the work that you and your colleagues have been doing in Jackson, Mississippi, make you guys an asset to the climate justice movement?
Well, I think many folks see what we've been doing in terms of being able to have a social movement, put one of our own into office, trying to find some creative ways to deal with the contradictions that come with such a move, but also see the kind of impact that we are able to have on shaping the discussion by sticking to a coherent strategy, sticking to our principles, being true to who we are, and calling the system out and calling the practices out, even when it's not necessarily popular, but making sure that we have a responsibility to educate people, and that's what we're going to do, so they clearly understand and not have some hocus pocus or some false solutions being presented to them. And to the extent that that's resonated with a good number of people in Jackson, have been able to kind of demonstrate itself through our ability to change policy in the municipality and have some impact on changing policy in the county. I think that is where a number of folks are looking at us as being a potential resource and a model that folks can learn from. For us, we see everything is in a reciprocal way. For us, you know we need to have solid allies on many different fronts of struggle out there, because our enemies, the right, far right, the capitalists, they don't sleep. They understand the importance oftentimes of our little victories more so than we do. And they are stepping up their game to make sure that there's no other slip-ups like what happened with Chokley in 2013, him getting elected and what that potentially could have created in terms of some policy shifts. So they're gearing up on us big time and putting all the weight of their finance machine into Jackson to make sure that we are choked. And so one of the primary ways we have to beat that is by reaching out to folks of like mind to share our politics, share our principles, understand our strategy and willingness to work with us in front of them in a way to execute it. We got to reach out. So that's one of the reasons we are seeking these alliances, to be in the climate justice alliance and part of our power campaign.
So how has the work been going in establishing worker cooperatives in Jackson without the presence of the late mayor, Chakwe Lumumba?
There's always challenges. Chakwe passing presented us with one set of challenges, you know, but him being in office was not going to change our impact on really organizing people. People have to understand that. I mean, we were still going to have to knock on the doors and go to workers where they're at and find those who are unemployed, which is the vast majority of our people in Jackson, and convince them that this is a method that could work. You know, that work was going to have to take place with or without him being there. And in some respects, to be, you know, completely honest with yourself and the audience, you know, now we have to deal with the real task of folks being convinced of the idea, not because there's some great patron that's going to just kind of grant jobs from on high, but it's very clear now that if this is going to become a real concrete reality, we have to create it collectively. So in that sense, I think it's a dose of reality that is very helpful, I think, going forward looking at this project. And to this point, we've been, you know, good in terms of bringing folks together, getting our working groups off the ground, doing some of the preliminary aspects of fundraising and networking if needed, to make sure that we can kind of grow and sustain, given the political challenges and the threats of the, you know, the right wing is already posing to us and trying to draw us out. So we're doing well in that matter. But, you know, it's a democratic process. It's going to take time. One of the critical pieces, we're going to be launching a major initiative within the next month or 2 months called the Sustainable Communities Initiative. That will be kind of one of our foundation stones, if you will, you know, laying some firm roots in the Jackson community on a material basis that will enable the cooperatives to grow and thrive over the course of the next coming months and years.
What do you mean, laying some firm roots on a material basis?
One of the primary things we're looking to do is create a land trust and a housing co-op. And some of these are primary weapons we need to employ to fight the onslaught of gentrification, which is trying to make some major advances in Jackson. Folks are on the other side of the equation, the reactionary side of the equation, are kind of gathering their forces and deploying resources to their forces on the ground to move their agenda. So, you know, we're in a very contested space, as you understand. But we need to make sure that we move and generate some resources to be able to secure some sizable real estate and then decommodify it to the best extent that we can by creating this land trust, you know, so we can then grow and ensure that these resources are going to be in the hands of working class people in the future and not just put on the market to the highest bidder, which winds up displacing us and fostering the forces of gentrification and come in and move a whole new agenda, which doesn't have the interests of black people in mind whatsoever.
And how can the other constituent groups in the Climate Justice Alliance be helpful in Jackson?
Well, they can be helpful by connecting us to the different kind of technical expertise that folks have acquired in terms of how do you do sustainable development? How do you do sustainable urban agriculture? How do you produce a sustainable factory that produces recycled products? Or how do you produce solar panels and things of that nature in a cheap way? There's a lot of knowledge and skill that's out there that we can kind of tap into and bring into Jackson so that we can train more of our folks on the ground to acquire those skills and be self-sufficient and being able to involve themselves in that productive activity. But there's also other ways. You know, it's the political struggle that has to take place on a regional level, on the national level, and even international level, that they help us with and can help us with in various connections. And then it's us really hunkering down and trying to figure out a way in which we raise resources, generate resources collectively and distribute them collectively as a movement. And we're trying to tackle some of those questions, you know, with a broad divest and reinvest campaign, which is really starting to emerge and kind of get off the ground. You know, so there's some practical concrete ways that this relationship, I think, is going to be beneficial to Cooperation Jackson, and Cooperation Jackson, I think, will be beneficial to the overall social movement around climate justice that the CJA is trying to put forward.
That was Kali Akundo of Cooperation Jackson and the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement.
President Obama has speeded up deportations of Central American refugees trying to enter the country. Anti-immigrant fever is nothing new in the United States, according to Mumia Abu-Jamal, America's best-known political prisoner.
As an ineffectual Congress gives voice to howling throngs decrying the influx of Central American children, it's helpful to learn that this is not a new feature of American immigration, but as old as the country itself. From the time of the first European colonial settlements in North America, there was a tendency to declare those arrivals natives while questioning and challenging the nationality of successive immigrants. That challenge often took the form of challenging the Americanness of new arrivals, who were often ridiculed and socially marginalized for speaking with ethnic accents, eating certain foods, or wearing certain clothing deemed un-American. While such behavior reveals a real insecurity among so-called nativists, it also betrays uncertainty about what American is, for it substitutes what is popular for that which is deemed American or acceptable. Over decades and generations, Irish, Italians, Germans, and Jews faced cultural and social rejection, not to mention other groups who, as deemed non-white, were exposed to deep prejudices for failing to make the grade. When Catholics arrived in the 19th century, they were damned as agents of popery who were threats to American democracy. They were called serpents and enemies to America. Hatred of Catholics were important elements to the growth of the Ku Klux Klan and similar anti-foreigner groups. Over time, such powerful feelings have dissipated. But as we notice today, it doesn't take much to spark it back up again, as we see with the children of Central America. Every generation, anxious about their place in this turbulent society, gives new arrivals hell, for they challenge their very sense of security.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, reporting for Prison Radio.
The Senate Intelligence Committee continues to wrestle with the CIA over declassification of a report on the agency's torture practices. Shahid Buttar, executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, says a great deal is at stake in this fight.
Everything from human rights to democracy, government transparency, and the ability of the Senate to do its job. At the end of the day, what this story is about is the CIA committing torture crimes far beyond what we have heard about publicly revealed, far beyond what was revealed at Abu Ghraib, far beyond the CIA black sites, enough to fill a 6,000-page report about it that the Senate spent $40 million in several years compiling. After committing those torture crimes, the CIA destroyed the evidence of it, obstructing justice to compound its human rights offenses, and then, when investigated by the Senate, hacked the Senate servers, infiltrated the Senate computer system, stole documents from the Senate, and then filed false allegations with the Justice Department seeking the prosecution of those Senate staffers. So basically, this is about compounding crimes by the CIA and the Senate's long overdue effort to rein that agency in. And as I would describe right now, it's the high watermark, at least to this point, of the CIA's accountability since the Church Committee going back 30 years. And I really do hope very much that the Senate is able to gain access to more of the reports or released to the public. We still don't know, quite frankly, the first thing about the extent of the CIA's assault on human rights that continue to undermine U.S. national security, that continue to undermine our own constitutional rights, and continue to undermine our own international treaty obligations.
Yes, is the CIA not simply covering up past crimes and obstructing justice in the process, but also covering up ongoing operations?
It very well could be. You know, the particular CIA ongoing operation that's proved most recently controversial are the drone strikes in Yemen and Pakistan. And transparency has been a big problem there because throughout the controversy, which held up the confirmation of the CIA director for almost 3 months last year, throughout that controversy, the CIA has claimed, as a military-industrial complex, and President Obama has claimed that drone strikes save lives because they're surgical and they're targeted. And, you know, we don't bomb entire villages, we just bomb a house, except that, according to the only independent study, as far as I know, one by Stanford and NYU, a joint analysis conducted by the human rights programs at their respective law schools, over 90% of the victims of drone attacks are civilians, which is to say they're not so targeted at all. And what's the truth? Who knows? Because the CIA has the facts and hides them all, just like it did on torture for 10 years. And the fact of the matter, simply, is that secrecy begets abuse. And the CIA is wedded to secrecy, and we shouldn't be surprised that he commits crimes wantonly under the shadow of secrecy. And I hope that the effort to gain transparency on torture does enable us to have greater transparency going forward into other things that the agencies might be doing to our names.
The Senate committee is not just facing obstruction by the CIA. The CIA seems to be back to the hilt by the president.
It is so disturbing to see the co-optation of the Obama presidency by the very same actors that he ran against. You know, John Brennan was a counterterrorism official under the Bush administration, just like Obama's first Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates. How President Obama is promising change we can believe in and inherits a counterterrorism staff and then promotes this person to the directorship of the CIA. And let's realize, you know, John Brennan, the director of the CIA, his prior role before being confirmed to that position was basically the chief drone targeter. He would go to the White House every Tuesday and sit down with the president, and they would choose who would live and who would die. And that's a bad role for anyone to be a CIA director. It's a bad role, period. I mean, the president shouldn't be doing that. No one should be doing that. But the fact that the president was enmeshed in so obvious an assault on human rights is really disturbing. And, you know, what would the president's response be in his heart of hearts? Well, I was trying to make sure that they didn't kill everybody else, too, and maybe that is what he meant. But the fact of the matter is the mere fact that he's choosing who lives and dies with someone doesn't qualify them to be the director of what is the world's arguably most successful terror organization.
But what President Obama seems to be doing is embracing these past CIA practices as his own, as the kill list president.
And I think that that embracing of the intelligence agencies and their serial abuses, you know, it's not just the CIA torture that President Obama has chosen to cover up. You know, he's also covered up the NSA spying stuff and tried to preserve it. At least on torture, he said generally that he wants to stop it. Though it's interesting, you know, there was recently a release by Jason Leopold and Jeff Kay, and they're a pair of investigative journalists with some expertise on detention and torture issues. They released an analysis noting that the president didn't even actually stop all uses of torture. He only banned some of the torture techniques. So even President Obama is defending even CIA torture, in addition to covering up the abuses to protect the criminals from justice. And I think that that move, that co-optation of his presidency, that decision to ally himself with powerful criminals running three-letter agencies funded by tax dollars is unfortunately the defining element of his legacy. And I think that for all of his lofty aims in terms of addressing some deeds of the American people, and in spite of his premature receipt of the Nobel Peace Prize, which is preposterous in retrospect, I think he will come to be remembered as the president who cracked down on whistleblowers to a greater extent than any other ever in our republic's history, led the war on transparency values that he publicly proclaimed to represent, and unfortunately entrenched and extended the Bush legacy of constitutional violations. I think especially coming from someone with an academic expertise in constitutional law, it is profoundly disappointing.
A host of those three-letter and four-letter agencies contribute to various lists that put American citizens, as well as people from all around the world, but American citizens on watch lists and no-fly lists, 20,000 of them, according to a recent report by Glenn Greenwald's news organization.
And I think the numbers go well above that. And, we've seen the no-fly lists used as retaliatory measures to basically keep U.S. citizens who are activists out of the country. I mean, I'll be honest, it's one of the reasons I haven't traveled internationally in some time is, despite being a U.S. citizen, I don't have full confidence that I'd be able to come back. Most death. Yasin Bey, the prolific underground hip-hop artist who chose to undergo forced feeding and was videotaped doing it to experience what the experience was like that Guantanamo detainees subjected to. He's been blocked from returning to the country of his birth because presumably he is too incendiary a figure. And that, in a nation that claims to lead the free world and proclaim a First Amendment right to speech, is terrifying. The terror I am afraid of is not the one of militants abroad. It's the terror of my own, the agencies that my tax dollars support. That's who I'm terrorized by, and I think that's increasingly true for, unfortunately, tens of thousands, if not even more, Americans. And how do you get off a list if you're on it? How do you even find out that you're on in the first place? There's no due process here at all.
The Obama administration has drastically speeded up the deportation process of Central American refugees, adults as well as children, cutting short the time that they appear to have by virtue of law to appeal their deportation.
Why are they coming here? Because our multinational corporations are extracting the oil under their feet, destroying the forests where they live. We are making it untenable for them to live where they live. Just last week, an indigenous tribe from Peru apparently was discovered. It came out of the Amazon, and they were driven by basically logging and deforestation of their land. They're coming out of the forest. They're coming north because that's the only place left to go. And I think it's so disturbing that we are driving a crisis that we are refusing to deal with. We are responding with this ham-fisted, brutal kind of response. And don't forget, if you're not Native American or African-American, you came to this country through immigration. Even African-Americans came through immigration. It was forced migration. They're like, we are a nation of immigrants. And I am an immigrant. I was born in London, England, and I came to this country when I was 2. And my parents brought me here because as basically a religiously persecuted minority in a Muslim country, we were seeking freedom. And I have watched, as a constitutional lawyer in the United States of America, freedom fade on our watch. And I think that it's very disturbing that the country that ushered these principles into the modern world inspired not only the rest of the world to follow suit, but many people, including my parents, to come here seeking the principles that are inscribed in our founding documents, to see those principles disregarded. And I think that the erosion of process rights in the immigrant rights context, and I think mass hearings in languages that the participants don't understand, there's a pretty clear due process violation. It suggests where we are at as a country, and it's not, unfortunately, anywhere near the land of the free and the home of the brave that we claim to be. If we were either the land of the free or the home of the brave, quite frankly, we would do better by immigrants.
People have been talking in terms of slippery slopes and U.S. freedoms for a very long time.
We're all being spied on, regardless of what we do. We're all at risk for being profiled mercilessly based on the color of our skin or where we come from or what we say. We're all at risk for military detention without an opportunity to contest the basis for it. we're all at risk for torture by our own government. And in fact, people who blow the whistle on government crimes and resign their public careers, like Chelsea Manning, have been subjected to that. We don't live in a free country, and I think that it's very disturbing for a lot of people to realize that.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially our engineer, Martin Nwoga.